Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. We need to talk. We need to talk about Venezuela. It's in meltdown right now. Social, financial, economic, political. Now, is meltdown, is that too strong a term? I don't think so, because people are rioting. They're storming grocery stores because they're starving. Street justice is taking root. Death squads are roaming all over, which explains why the morgues of Caracas are overflowing. Inflation is running in the hundreds of percent officially, maybe more unofficially, and accelerating. And of course, Argentinians experienced a sort of thing like this back in 2001. It's close. And so we're wondering what sorts of lessons learned can be gleaned from that experience. Today, we are fortunate to be speaking with Fernando Aguirre, also known as Furful, author of Surviving the Economic Collapse and also Bugging Out and Relocating, two books. You should check them out. Furful experienced the hyperinflationary destruction of Argentina's economy in 2001, up close and personal, and has since dedicated his professional career to educating the public about his experiences and observations of the lingering aftermath. His blog, Surviving in Argentina, found at furful.blogspot.com, is covering the events as they unfold there as well as elsewhere and more general topics around the idea of navigating an economic dislocation wherever you happen to live. Now, given rising concerns, we're seeing this in major hedge fund operators, really large financial titans are beginning to express their concerns about the possibility of a much larger and unfortunate conclusion to central bank meddling, one that could sweep the world. And our listeners are increasingly asking to hear from voices that have firsthand experience of what it's like to live through a large upheaval, such as the one Venezuela is undergoing. So, Fernando, thank you so much for being with us today.
Chris, it's great to be talking with you again.
Okay, right from the top, what are the similarities between Venezuela and what you experienced in Argentina?
I think that the greatest points to keep in mind is overwhelming corruption. I mean, People sometimes get lost on what exactly went wrong in Argentina or Venezuela, what's happening right now, or even thinking of Brazil. What they all have in common is that the people in charge of running things had no real interest in doing things right. They really did not care about destroying the country. They just cared about filling their own pockets as much as possible. And that's exactly what you're seeing in Venezuela. They have this, I mean, you have this communist speech going on in Venezuela, and it was very similar to what the Kirchner government had in Argentina as well. Now, these are people that are wealthy beyond our wildest dreams. These are not people that have a problem with amassing huge fortunes. So they have no problem in doing this by any means possible.
So this corruption, obviously it leads to all sorts of problems. We're seeing very low investment back in the country. We're seeing a lot of the capital that does come from the country flee. I mean, this is in Venezuela, this is bizarre. We're talking about the country with the second largest stated oil reserves on the planet. I know it's the junk out of the Orinoco belt, but still bestowed with plenty of oil. Nigeria, another country with plenty of oil, but again, the just crushing sorts of poverty, corruption. How does that happen?
I understand how confusing it can be, but Chris, think of it this way. You have a country where water is more expensive than gasoline. Right. That's Venezuela. All right. What sense does that make? None. I mean, you had a guy, you had Hugo Chavez walking down the street and pointing with his finger and saying, nationalize this, nationalize that. And when he was saying nationalize, he was saying steal this. Well, he wasn't thinking he had any great plans or anything, any political grandeur things going on in his mind. He just wanted to steal as much as he could. And that's basically what populism is all about. You see it in Venezuela, you saw it in Argentina. The Kirchner government now has, right now they're talking about with a new president in Argentina, Macri, which is a much more serious type of person. They're talking about an entire year's GDP being stolen during the Kirchner government. So imagine what kind of corruption we're talking about.
An entire year's GDP. Is that what you just said?
Yes, that's exactly what I said.
Huh. Well, that seems like quite a lot. So that would be stealing $18 trillion from the U.S.
Yes, it's an entire structure of overpricing anything that's being done by the states, going to friends that are actually owners of companies that are owned by the same people in power, by the president at the time, Cristina and Néstor Kirchner. They basically stole in such a shameless way. And one of the things that's being said a lot in Argentina, and people are now just realizing, is all the money being stolen, it's not being stolen out of thin air, it's being stolen out of the people. You know, all that money that hasn't been invested in roads, in hospitals, in schools, that's all money that's missing, and it's in their pockets and in their bank accounts in Seychelles or wherever.
Now, this is this corruption idea of very interesting. I had, you know, when I have John Perkins on, Confessions of an Economic Hitman writer, author, he talks about this sort of corruption. It happens a lot. It's a very systemic thing. It's not just the United States doing it, but that there's a system in place which really encourages this behavior. And yeah, a lot of these leaders are encouraged to participate in this bribery. The IMF is involved, the World Bank, these big loans are created.
Absolutely.
The loans never actually enter the country they're supposed to be dedicated towards, although the assignment of the repaying those gets attached to the country. But the money, you know, goes from a server in a bank in New York to a server in a bank in New York, and that's it, right? And
okay.
And but many of these leaders think they're rich because they siphon that money off, they squirrel it away. But then, as Mr. Perkins said, they really don't actually have access to it, because as soon as they run afoul of what certain worldwide interests want, they're outed as corrupt dictators and the money is seized. So they never really actually had it,
right,
but it felt like it. But meanwhile, the country just gets looted. So are you saying that Venezuela is just at the tail end of a long run of corruption, and that's where its problems mainly stem from?
Yes, it's basically the end of a very sad story of out-of-control corruption fueled by a very populist president with, you know, that common speech of, we're going to be taking away from the rich and giving to the poor. And basically, I mean, that sounds all very much very Robin Hood, but who's really the rich? I mean, if you're the wealthiest guy in the country, who is it that you're stealing from to give to the poor? You're saying you're stealing from yourself? We know that's not true. No, you're not stealing from yourself to give to the poor or anything like that. So using that, and it's all very systematic. I mean, Chris, there's an entire agenda, and this isn't me with theories. I mean, this is facts. They had an entire plan of forming the mentality of people. In Argentina, they had a ministry of national thought, which was pretty much as bad as it sounds. The idea was to indoctrinate kids from a very early age, basically destroy their ability to read and understand text. Right now in Argentina, it's one-third, or I'm being generous with one-third, about half of the kids that even finish primary school, they don't understand what they're reading, right? They lack reading comprehension to such an extent. So when you have that kind of population, it's very easy to control them and steal from them and abuse them in all these ways.
Hmm. Well, that sounds familiar to other countries. Let me leave that topic for a moment.
Yeah.
So Venezuela, how bad are things there right now?
Well, it's pretty disastrous. I mean, there's an interesting website where they're showing what people actually have in their fridges, the food that they have. I mean, it's less than a grocery bag for any of us. I mean, a couple of bananas, half a bag of flour, and I mean, it's really desperate. And that's why you see people just, you know, truly starving, and it makes no sense. As you said, they have oil. They have a country that it's in the middle of a tropical region where they should be able to produce as much food as they could possibly want, and they're starving to death. I mean, last year they didn't have even toilet paper. What country ends up not having toilet paper?
Yeah, it's really tragedy at this point. But you know, the videos I've seen of people rioting's maybe the wrong word, very, very hungry people who've been queuing in line for 8 or 9 hours in the hot sun, being told the store is closed, get a little angry and say, I'm still hungry and I've got hungry kids at home, and then they they, you know, break into the store. I'm not sure that's the same as rioting per se, but it sounds to me like people are actually getting to starvation at this point, like losing weight.
Yes, and as you were explaining pretty accurate right now, it's not always as easy to say everyone that's, you know, looting and breaking into, it's not as simple as it always is, as it sometimes may seem. You know, these are, honestly, people are starving, right? And folks simply do not understand how complex that is. Now, I was reading in a forum, someone that was saying, well, that lady looks pretty fat and she's hungry. They don't even understand, most folks don't understand that many times people that have a weight problem, they are some of the poorest people around the world. They don't have the quality of food or the gym subscription that some other folks have. It's people that are really desperate. So, I mean, 6 months ago, I was writing about an incident in where one sister killed another over a pack of rice or flour, I think it was. These are honestly people that are very desperate.
And it's the pictures I've seen of the hospital conditions are just beyond third world at this point. And like Greece did a while ago, Venezuela's run out of basic medicines, and people who are on certain medicines are finding that they're not available at any price because the country doesn't have the hard currency to import them. So it's rapidly becoming a food crisis, a medical crisis, a security crisis. Yeah. It's really hitting the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, these people are really getting down to a very serious humanitarian situation at this point.
Again, we go back, the key word is corruption. You know what they did in Argentina during the middle of the Kirchner government? They replaced medicine for cancer patients with water. They stole the actual medicine. They charge it to the government as real medicine. The government would be paying for them. Of course, all this money was always channeled to the Kirchner family. But they were giving water to cancer patients and killing these people. Again, not anything that I'm making up. It's all available on the internet. And, you know, people are actually being judged for this right now. But those that are dead, they're not going to be coming back.
Now, do you think, let me guess, you think things are going to get worse in Venezuela before they get better?
I think that in the case of Venezuela, yes, because there's still, in the case of Argentina, fortunately, they changed. You know, you still need another year or so to see if really things are, if there's hope. You know, right now that we have Mauricio Macri for president, which is, you know, a guy that I never thought would actually, because he's a well-educated person, seems quite decent, which is a nice change. But, you know, you still need some more time. You need at least, I don't know, 6 months or a year to see if things. Now, in the case of Venezuela, they're really heading to, they're going to be crashing bad before they see something better. And they haven't still gotten to that point. Until you actually have people, decent people in the government, there's really no hope.
Well, now, what's the chance there of something more serious, like a coup, a civil war, a rebellion of some kind, do you think?
I mean, Chris, it's already very bad. I mean, how much worse? People are, I know for a fact, they're slaughtering one another on the streets right now in Venezuela. And it's not just now. It's been for at least 3 years that I know of, it's been a case of out of control crime and corruption over there, and people have been having a significant percentage of the population has been struggling with food for at least a year as well now. So it really, it's not going to be getting better anytime soon unless something changes in a deeper level.
All right, so let me ask you this. Assume for the moment you're not one of the lucky ones who can leave. And I know a lot of Venezuelans who have left to go to Miami is really, yeah, it's a study in Venezuela in some sections. And so those are the people who could afford to leave. Let's assume you're not one of those people and you're in Venezuela. What would you be doing right now?
Well, as you mentioned, the people that actually left, those are the ones that have the right strategy. I mean, for the average middle-class person in Venezuela, it takes them. And I'm talking about the middle class, even a little bit of an upper middle class, right? Educated, a good job. he needs 2 years of wages to buy a single plane ticket in their own economy, in their own Bolivar currency. He needs to work for 2 full years to buy one single. I mean, that average middle-class person is stuck there. The problem is that he waited too long, and he didn't manage to leave. This is something that I write about pretty often is, know when you have to leave. I mean, mm-hmm. the moment to leave when Venezuela was at least 3-4 years ago, right? Right now, you're getting into that point where you're stuck there. Now, you're stuck in a country where no matter what it is that you do, you're always going to be earning in Bolivar, which is a currency that is completely fake. They have an exchange rate, official exchange rate, of $1 to $10, I believe. But unofficially, which is the real one, it's almost like $1 to $1,000. So they're basically starving you to death through the economy, through a completely devalued currency, which is what you're getting paid for. You basically need to find ways of leaving the country. What I would do if I was in Venezuela right now, I would leave on foot. I would leave any way I could because it's not safe. It's definitely, I know people that have killed people to survive in Venezuela. I actually know guys that had to do that to live. And the only solution you have is you cannot stay there. All right? If you had, and again, if folks that have a fridge with a couple bananas and an orange, how can you sustain life like that? At the same time, if you're thinking of farming, you have the government that stole people's land as well. And I mean, Chavez, he privatized those farms. Those folks are thinking of, okay, I'm going to be buying a chunk of land and growing my own food. You cannot do that when you have a government stealing it from you. And you're not going to be winning against the government's military or the government's police. It's a no-win situation.
Hmm. So let's rewind then. What were the warning signs that Venezuelans should have been listening to, if they could have, before things got bad? And how long ago were those, and what were those warning signs?
Well, again, the similarities with Argentina. Many years, people in Argentina were saying, we're turning into Venezuela. And there was actually a phrase, a word coined, which was Argenzuela, because Argentina was looking so much like Venezuela that the local joke for us was, we're turning into Argenzuela, right? We're turning into Venezuela. And you see the same thing. It's almost you see it so clearly. You see a populist leader rise, and he has this hate speech, which is something that, unfortunately, we're seeing in many places around the world these days. But that hate of, that class hate of we're the poor ones, they're the rich ones. And it's true that, I mean, at the end of the day, you know it as well as I do, that behind everything, behind all of this, there's always big bankers that are running things, right? But when you have this kind of a populist leader with that socialist, communist thing going on, and he says he's going to be stealing and nationalizing stuff and getting it back to you. And one of the things he does is right away he tries to control the media. And, of course, when he cannot control the media because their own desires clash with reality, they want people to believe something that's not true. So you get desperate with the media. They try to control it, to censor it any way they can. They start closing media outlets that are not affiliated to them. Those are the real serious warning signs.
All right. And so those signs had been cropping up for a while. And things are clearly very bad in Venezuela. We've been writing about it for a while and commenting on it, but the articles just come on a daily basis. Failed state, collapse, things like that. So it's clearly on a bad road. So I agree with you. I think that if you have the chance, even if it's by foot, it's probably best to leave. But let's talk about some other places where maybe we're seeing those same warning signs. So where do we start even? Let's start with Argentina. How are things shaping up there? Reinvited to the international bond market, some recent political turnover. How are things looking there?
Right. Last year, it was December last year, there were elections, and Cristina Kirchner lost those elections to Mauricio Macri. Mauricio Macri is a rich guy from a rich family, a business, a rather wealthy family from Argentina that had been around for some time now. His father was actually the one that had the big company, and Mauricio Macri is actually an engineer. He speaks English somewhat fluently. He's well educated, and he is someone that was pretty much interested in keeping his family business. He had an interest in football, what you guys call soccer, and became the president of Boca Juniors Club, which is a pretty big a club in Argentina, which is, you know, it's a big deal in Argentina football. So that was his pretty much first step in politics. Then he got into politics when the Kirchner government started doing its populist thing, and whenever someone complained about something, they said, okay, if you have a problem with us, start your own party and win the elections. And that's exactly what Mauricio Macri did. He started his own political party, brand new, picking up the people that he thought it would be good for the job. So you see Macri with a pretty much everyone in his political party is well educated and has a good background of transparency, and you know, there's always something a little bit gray there, here and there, but in general, honestly, it's maybe one of the best things we had going on in terms of politics since as long as I can remember, definitely in the last 30 years. So you have a guy that honestly seems to be, people want to, if you want to put him in some box, you would say he's a center-right type of conservative type of person. I think he's more of a center, though. But the, again, the important thing is that he doesn't have that corruption thing going for him, which the Kirchner definitely had. They were the exact opposite. But you still need at least a year or so, because there's still very much, I mean, the Kirchner government made sure there was an entire generation, as we were talking about before, an entire generation of people that thought that it was right to be corrupt and to steal through the government. So what is it that you do with thousands of people like that, hundreds of thousands of people like that? It's not going to be an easy job, but I think it's a good start.
I paraphrase a famous scientist who said that science advances one funeral at a time. People with belief systems that are entrenched, sometimes you really literally have to wait for them to die before those belief systems will go away, because that's how the world works for them, and that's how they see the world. So I understand that it's a real tragedy to have a whole generation of corrupt, inoculated people who grew up that way, or in the case of Greece and even Spain, which I understand I'm calling you in, which we'll get to in a minute, but having a huge, huge chunk, 50% or more of young people out of work has a corrosive long-term effect. So that corrosion of society, I get it. It's a really big deal, and I think it's overlooked. So thank you for bringing that up. Now, let's shift just a little north from Argentina. How about Brazil? That's really in the news. It seems to be having trouble finding its footings. If you lived in Brazil, are you seeing warning signs there that would say time to go to Miami?
Right. Brazil is definitely not as bad as Venezuela by any means. It always was a third world country. It's not a politically correct term, but it is what it is. A third world country simply lacks that kind of structure that allows, you know, in a developed nation with stability, you can put a turtle for a president, and for a term or two, the country will still roll, right?
Yeah.
Now, in places like Argentina or Brazil or Venezuela, which don't have that stability, you really need someone to change course. Maybe a guy like Macri. Right now in Brazil, they have Dilma Rousseff, which has been removed from the presidency, and it's going through a pretty serious political crisis. It's hard to say exactly how that will end up. I think that they will, especially with the examples that you have around, when you have your neighbors going like you have Venezuela, then people are more likely to say, okay, let's calm down a little bit and see how we can fix things. Unless we end up like those guys, you know? So that's always an encouragement. I know it was for Argentina. Argentina, maybe the greatest fear we had as Argentines was ending up like them, ending up like Venezuela. We never wanted that, correct? If people in Brazil, I assume, will try to fix things, but it's definitely going through a serious political crisis.
So, Fernando, is that in Brazil, it's a political crisis at this point, but it's not yet economic or monetary?
Well, it's not doing great economically, because it is affecting, of course, the economy. I mean, as you well know, the economy is all about trust. I mean, the fiat currency we use is pure trust in a piece of paper. So as soon as people lose faith in a country and its economy and its ability to answer, then the economy starts struggling pretty bad. But it still has, I mean, Brazil is the largest economy in South America, so it still has a little bit of backbone left to get back on track. But it's definitely suffering. It'll need a little bit more time to see if it gets back on its feet or not.
Okay. Well, how about Puerto Rico, though? We're looking at, it's bankrupt at this particular stage, so they're going through debt restructurings. Situation I'm not as familiar with in terms of how much corruption has played a role in what's happened there, whether that was just good old-fashioned mismanagement in Puerto Rico or how much corruption might have been welded in. What's your view there?
I think that Puerto Rico has its fair share of corruption. It's smaller, which makes it easier to fix. You know, it doesn't have the leverage like bigger country has, but it's also somewhat easier. Puerto Rico always had that, you know, fiscal paradise thing going for it, and many expats it chose it as a location. So with that kind of it still has a little bit of hope of getting back on track, but it's nowhere near as serious as Venezuela. And I think it's going to be, you know what? Always when there's people with money and we have their own interests in place, usually a way is found to get things fixed.
Well, all right. So Europe then. I have increasing bets in my brain about the idea that Europe is not going to survive a lot longer as a single union. And I know that's maybe slightly controversial view, but the refugee crisis, the way that you know, second state status has been granted and shoved down Greece's throat, and it's probably going to visit some of the other southern European nations over time. Italy is fully bankrupt as a nation. I don't, you know, but yet things sort of carry on. Well, you're living over there now. What's your views from the street view? What are you seeing?
I'm actually in Costa del Sol, very close to Malaga, which is, you know, the southern part of Spain, and actually right in front of the ocean now. The Mediterranean Sea, not the ocean. That would be a difficult spot.
You get sunshine there.
Yeah, a lot of it. Yes. So it's a beautiful place, really.
Yeah.
It's full of tourists, and well, that's the thing. The thing about Europe that maybe not a lot of people, you know, have that much of an understanding, especially if they haven't traveled through it. It's a collection of countries, really, and each country has its own, very rich culture in terms of, you know, thousands of years of history. And each country, even though right now it's the European Union, each country has its way of dealing with things. I think that, for example, Spain, you would say, you look at the kind of even put together a government, you would think people are at one another's throat on the street, and really that's not the case. It's quite peaceful. They have a little bit more of a relaxed way of viewing things. They went through a pretty big crisis, which they're somewhat recovering from. It's still unemployment is still an issue, but at the same time, you walk, you know, on the streets and you see some signs of jobs wanted and such. So it's definitely not good, but it's not as disastrous as it may seem. Especially one of the things I try to explain is the difference between crisis and collapse. Venezuela is collapsing right now. You know, it has been collapsing for some time. Argentina collapsed. Collapse, in my mind, means the president resigns and escapes in a chopper, like we saw in 2001, right? And people start burning everything, you know? And no one wants to even be president of the country. You know, that's what collapses in my mind. Crisis is still very bad, and, you know, when you have that kind of economic crisis, and you see such a shift from middle class to poor, it's a real tragedy. I mean, it's no joke, definitely not. But for example, here in Spain, there's not the level of crime that we saw in Argentina, not nearly. Mm-hmm. anything like that. People here walk along the streets and it's safe at 3 a.m. It's definitely much more safer than many other places I've been to. The murder rate is like a fifth of what it is in the United States. So it's still a safe place to be. Now, what you were mentioning about the integrity of the European Union, and especially now with Brexit, with Britain thinking about leaving and such, it can be compromised, and there is always the possibility of things going south pretty fast.
Yeah, well, that's the piece I'm sort of tracking here. So here in the United States, and I'd love to get your views on how Europe is sort of watching this circus of a presidential cycle over here, but before we go there, there's a growing discontent in the United States between the protected class and the unprotected class. So the unprotected has a much harder run of it here in the United States than many places in Europe, because we don't do a social safety net thing here. You know, you get a few weeks of unemployment if you happen to have been working in a job that qualified, and then you're out. Meanwhile, we're just absolutely screwing ourselves every possible way we can with healthcare, food costs, you know, you name it. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, like if you can get away with charging people for it, that's fine. So people are getting squeezed, and we're seeing it really show up. I was starting to detect strains of that, particularly around the refugee crisis, where there was a little bit of a cultural crisis going on, which I totally understand. You know, when you have a culture and you try and drop ship a whole bunch of young males in particular who are insistent on bringing their own culture in, there's some shock involved with that. You can't just sort of have Brussels wave their bureaucratic wands and say you have to suck it up because we say so. So that's what I thought the Brexit was about, was more and more ordinary people saying, hey, that ruling body in Brussels seems really out of touch and bureaucratic and kind of heavy-handed, and increasingly so. We don't want any part of that. Is that a reasonable characterization, or is that saying going too far?
There's probably some of that. The thing is, I'm always, giving my experience so far, I distrust governments in general. I distrust the mainstream media a great deal. I know that there's always interest involved. I mean, look at what's happening, for example, with Brexit. Who's going to be benefiting from it? Is it really, I mean, I see the media being fueling it on a certain direction, which they may have a point in some things. Then again, right now, I mean, you're running right now. I mean, they have a Muslim mayor in London. That didn't happen in the last 6 months or 12 months. There's an entire community over there already in place, you know? So is it really that why they want to be leaving, or is it maybe some financial interest that will benefit greatly from separating itself from the European Union and some of the things that they don't like as much about it? I tend to be quite distrustful. It is very true what you're saying about having such a mass of people. And I have refugees here. I see them. Honestly, there's a lot of people that have been here far longer than many of us, maybe for several generations, with their own cultural thing, and it does clash. They have their ideas of how you should treat one another, how you treat women. Maybe I don't agree with them that much. You know what I mean? I think it's always possible at the end. If you really try, you can live together. I think it's possible to have peace, even if you have different ideas of what a family is and how you manage yourself and your loved ones. It's not always easy. And
I agree, but it's definitely easier if you have ample resources and there's plenty of jobs and people aren't fighting for basic survival. But when get down to Venezuela, when you're in crisis, for sure, but especially when you go to collapse, I think that those cultural frictions, that's when they really amplify, become very problematic.
Well, think of it as Tinder just waiting there, and you just throw a spark, and it's the perfect excuse for a lot of ugly stuff, so to put it some way. Yeah. So, yes, it is a problem. It is an issue. Then again, it's also true that, you know, people, at the end of the day, people make money for governments. You know, when you import hundreds of thousands of people, yes, there's a lot of problems involved with that, but it also means an increase in your capital as well as a country. So it's, maybe I look at it different because I am, you know, from Argentina. My grandparents came from Spain to Argentina, and I married a descendant of Italians in Argentina. You know, so I have maybe a little bit of a different perspective of what it means to be an immigrant, what it means to make a new country your own. I feel 100% Argentine myself, but I also understand my cultural the Spanish culture that I inherited and the Italian culture that my wife inherited for herself. And, you know, it somehow ends up working. But yes, it is true that with an economic problem, an economic crisis, it's going to be a little bit more complicated.
I understand. So let me ask you this then, as honestly as you can, you did move from Argentina in, with your family, and you did that because you wanted to leave a worsening situation for hopefully a better one. Do you any regrets? And what's, so I'm interested, what's worked well and what do you miss?
Yes, I'm definitely happy I left, no doubt about that. I mean, even now, you know, I was just talking with my grandmother, 92 years old, and she really misses me a great deal. And she was talking about, you know, how things are, you know, with the new government, things will improve. I mean, this is what I do. I know that it's going to be taking at least another 10 years for the country. If everything works great, another 10 years for the country to be fixed. You cannot just rush back because of a new president, especially not in a place that lacks that kind of stability that is enjoyed in other places. So definitely it was a very good thing to leave Argentina, even though it's not always easy and it's quite painful to leave your country behind. But they're definitely worse today than they were 4 years ago or 5 years ago when I left. But when I first left, I went to Ireland, Northern Ireland, and it was I wanted my kids to have the experience that I had when I moved to Boston when I was little. I lived over there for 3 years, and it really helped me. And you know, I'm actually speaking to you and somewhat trying to be fluent in English, but it's thanks to that experience. And it's not just the language; it's the experience of having lived in another place, having that. You know, I learned to appreciate many American things that I integrate into my own family.
Yeah.
So I wanted my kids to have that. We got that in Ireland, but Ireland is a fantastic place, and I have recommended it to people that have moved there and cannot thank me enough for it. They're very happy there. The climate thing is a little bit tricky, you know. The rain especially gets old after some time. I guess that what I'm trying to say is we got what we wanted from that experience. At the same time, I am both Argentine and Spanish is my language and my culture, and I wanted my kids to have that as well. So that's why we're in Spain right now and really enjoying it.
Yeah, and so when you decided that it was time to move from Ireland, was there any consideration of going back to Argentina?
No, not at all, really.
Right.
Not because we understand very well the difference between a developed country and a country that hasn't gotten to that stage yet. South America is still, it has lots of potential, especially a place like Argentina is huge. It has such a small population, which, you know, you would think, you know, it has everything for it. Massive lands of all kinds and somewhat educated population. Yet, with all this political problems that it has, and one more thing, it really hasn't got that wave of immigrants of different cultures clashing. Argentines are 99% Argentine people, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They have that somewhat of a same religion and same, basically they're coming from either Spain or Italy, so pretty uniform in that regard. But the political aspect is what ends up ruining everything. So no, we knew that it wasn't easy to leave Ireland as well, because as I'm saying, it's a great place to be in. But we decided we wanted something a little bit more It's what we were used to, the Spanish culture thing of ours, and especially the climate. Again, being completely honest, the climate was probably the biggest thing for us. As do we really want to be living 10 years more under a cloud, damp all the time? Yeah. Beautiful place, though. I mean, not regretting for a second.
All right. So, yeah, of course you ended up on the Mediterranean. That makes sense. So let me switch gears with the time we have left real quick. So I mentioned you had two books, and one is Surviving the Economic Collapse, and the second one, Bugging Out and Relocating. So we've discussed the relocating part because you've done that. The bugging out part, when we start talking about bugging out, a lot of people think, oh, gosh, that's okay. Now we're talking something that's apocalyptic. It's really unlikely. I won't have to do that. But the good people at Fort McMurray in Alberta, Canada, I had to do exactly that recently on really short notice. And you wrote about that experience. So what kind of learnings came from that experience, do you think?
Well, in the book, I actually describe pretty accurately what those people had to end up going through. In the book, I explained that bugging out may be a number of things. Bugging out basically means that wherever it is that you are right now is no longer possible. It's not no longer viable. You may have 5 seconds, 5 minutes, five hours, or 5 weeks to leave, right? But the point is, you still have to go. If you have a fire like that, you have just maybe seconds to leave. So you need to have a plan ahead of time so as to know, okay, go through the mental exercise of, if I have to leave right this moment, just get into my car and leave, what is it that I have to work with? If you have a warning of a storm or flood heading your way, you have maybe a little bit more time. Can you grab a bag, your bug out bag, or some other gear? Where is it that you're going to be going? What route are you going to be taking? And once you start doing that, you start thinking of, okay, I'm going to be taking this route. I'm going to be needing this much gas to get there. This is what I'm going to be finding when I get there. You start thinking of bug out locations, or where is it that you're going to be going? I get mad sometimes when people say, I already live in my bug out location. I immediately tell them it's impossible. If you're already living there, no matter how rural it is, how great it is, or how fantastic your place is, it's no longer your bug out location because it has to be somewhere else. Basically, that's the idea behind bugging out. It's when your current place of residence is no longer viable. Once you live there, no longer a bug out location. Now, it may be the case of something like people saw in Venezuela, or I saw in Argentina, when that slow change where you have months, maybe even years to leave, but you always, you know, that normalcy bias thing, people say, no, this cannot be happening, this will get better, and sometimes it does not. It simply does not get better, just get worse. Think of it, Venezuela, think of Ukraine. People that were living there a few years ago, completely at peace, suddenly, those that didn't leave, some of them actually ended up dying there because they didn't leave in time. Some folks left when their homes were shelled, and they just left with the clothes on their backs. So what I say is don't think it's never going to be happening to me, because millions, literally millions, have thought that and, you know, wish they had planned different.
So let's talk about, you know, Fort McMurray. I was reading accounts where some people had 0 minutes, like they're at work and they're like, oh, you're being evacuated. They didn't even have a chance to go home and get their bug out bag. Other people were just, you know, suddenly it was a blue day. And now it's suddenly a dark day and they're being told they have to leave. So they had minutes, and a few other people had slightly longer amounts of time. But the overriding thing that I learned was that very few people heeded the messages early. Right. So there was a couple of stories I found where people were just like, got a gut sense. They knew it was going to be bad and they left before everybody else. You know, there were still time to be in the gas station. And just minutes later, there would be 200 cars lined up because nobody had enough gas for the trip they were going to have to take, things like that. So if you were going to advise people there or any other place that could be affected by a calamity like that, what should everybody have prepared way in advance?
You should have a plan. You should have an idea of where it's that you're going to be going. If where you are right now is no longer possible, what I explain also in the book is, ideally, you would have someone within your neighborhood, say a neighbor, a family member, someone that if it's an isolated incident where your own house burns down, it happens to people every single day. Where is it that you're going to be going? Can you go to someone else's house nearby for some time until you get back on your feet? also have someone a little bit further away in the next county, right? That means that if something more widespread, like we had, like what happened in Canada, takes place, and the immediate mid-range is no longer good, you have somewhere else further away to go. You need to have all these options. The more options you have, the better. In the case of something maybe like what happens in Venezuela, where the entire country is going down, if you have people in other places, if you keep in touch with someone that left, family, friends, that could, you know, I know folks that left and stayed in someone's living room until they got a job and got back on their feet. You know, it happens. It's life. So having these plans ahead of time, it really helps a great deal.
And so most of these people, you know, the accounts were, they didn't have a plan. They didn't really know what to do. So there's a lot of confusion. Things sorted themselves out, I think it all was handled really well with you know, no loss of life, a lot of loss of property. That was pretty interesting to see how that all shook out. And at the same time,
The thing to keep in mind, though, sorry, Chris, is that it is Canada. You know, same thing happens in other places. You know, as well as I do, there would have been significant loss of life, no doubt.
Yeah, no, I was astonished. I even commented on this, and I think one Canadian on my site took exception. But I'm watching this video. It's front and rear dash cam footage, and behind this guy's truck is a guy on a motorcycle, and there's just a wall of flames there, and this guy's wincing away from it, and there's a whole empty lane for oncoming traffic that's not oncoming because everybody's leaving, right? And it's not being used, right? And there's all these four-wheel trucks, and they're all in this orderly line with this wall of flames right there, and it's just in a suburban neighborhood. I tell you, way before that happened in America, the trucks would have like gone four-wheeling across people's lawns. Like, it would have been you know, that guy on the motorcycle would have absolutely been just tearing up the sidewalk, you know, or whatever. But there they all were in a line, very, very polite and very orderly. So I think, you know, that really speaks to the cultural capital and how much that plays out in a crisis or a collapse. And when your culture has been ruined by corruption and lack of trust and every man for himself, I think things go bad worse more quickly. And I think you're right. That's, you know, when I asked you about Venezuela, you started right on that. Like, this is a corrupt country, and that's why it's so bad right now.
In Venezuela, I know for a fact, it would have been everyone for himself. Those lanes would be completely covered with people. Many of the cars would have stalled or broken down in the middle of the thing because of lack of, it's all in those little details. You know, every guy in Canada has an idea of, be responsible. My car has to work for myself and for others as well. You know, in places like Latin America, it's, my car is okay if it breaks down in the middle of the road and I end up causing problems for thousands of people. You know, that's not my problem. That kind of mentality, at the end of the day, causes everyone problems. When you have such an organized society, it's of course much better. Life is better in general.
Absolutely. And so that's at least part of, I love the distinction you made that there's a big difference between developing and developed and all of that. Final question then is about how long do you think the developed countries are going to stay that way? You and I have been tracking this potential financial and economic collapse for a long time. I'm surprised, Fernando, I'm surprised by how long it's taken. How about you? Are you surprised by how this is unfolding, or do you see anything on the horizon that concerns you at this point, or do you think, wow, they've proven the power of money printing? It actually works.
No, I don't think that. Just, you know, I think that the plan is going along just as everything is going as planned. What you're seeing, and you're seeing in many places, is a lot of people from the middle class are starting to become poor.
That's true.
And this is the kind of thing that, as we were saying before, it's not covered as well by the media because there's always their own interest. But it's, you know, it to be true in the United States, a lot of people that used to be middle class are no longer middle class anymore.
47% of people, 47% of respondents to the last Fed survey couldn't come up with $400 in an emergency without borrowing it or selling something. 47%. If middle class is the middle of your country, the middle of my country can't come up with $400.
Okay, Chris, what does that tell you?
There is no middle class anymore. You know, that that so-called middle-class band is shrinking and climbing up the
ladder. Yeah, let's be generous and say that there is still some, but it's shrinking, and it's shrinking every single year. Every year it gets smaller and smaller, and those guys that used to be able to do certain things and have certain quality of life, they're losing it little by little to that trickle, little bit of a financial ability and quality of life that's been taken away from them. And of course, it's going in one direction. You know, someone, I know that I never accidentally made $1 billion. I don't know if you know someone that actually did that. Whenever someone goes like, "Whoops, I made $1 billion," like, "Oh well, it wasn't an accident, my friend. You actually planned for that, and you executed very beautifully, and it worked great for you." But all that shrinking middle class is going to that little bunch of guys that are taking a great benefit from it. That means, you know, I think that as years go by, that's going to be happening. It's going to be that struggle of, you know, clawing your way up that iceberg, so as to say, on top of it.
Yeah, the way I see it is that because of the amount of debt we have, because of the shrinking resource base that's out there, that the pie doesn't expand like it used to. And unfortunately, we have a debt-based money system, which means that there's always a siphon that's vacuuming wealth from the bottom to the top. That's just how the system works. I'm not going to say if it's good or bad. It's a feature. But the problem comes in when the pie is no longer expanding, that vacuum is still sucking at its normal rate. And so you just get less and less is left at the bottom and more accumulates at the top. And that creates an unstable situation. So that's what we're seeing politically in this country, in the United States. We've got Donald Trump's fans expressing one form of dissatisfaction, Bernie Sanders another, with Hillary representing the corrupt class who want everything to stay corrupt, or whatever she represents. I'm not clear on that, what the attraction there is. But so there's sort of a status quo, keep everything moving by Hillary, and let's change things from Trump and Sanders. But that let's change things, I think, is just representing people who are increasingly feeling squeezed and pinched. Many of them don't actually understand why. Because you're right, it isn't well reported on. We don't really talk about it. Sometimes they throw big statistics around. But the truth is there is a systematic looting of the middle class, and it's being done with regulations and lobbying and rule changes and stifling barriers to growth that favor big companies over small companies. So my judgment for my country, the engine of growth has always been small and medium-sized companies, and those are just getting killed. So we're busy in the process of killing the goose that laid the golden egg over here, and not actually talking about what's happening realistically.
Yeah,
that's how I see it.
Yeah, it's more like placing a chain around the goose's neck and squeezing it for all that it's worth, and it's no longer giving you that beautiful golden egg. It's just a little pebbles or grains of gold, and they're just killing it, trying to get more out of it. That's the image that they have, you know.
That's...
I think that unfortunately nothing's going to be changing politically. I mean, it's already, I mean, with the candidates that you have, you know that nothing's going to be changing, no matter who wins at this point.
I know, that's
honestly,
the greatest.
What's going to be changing?
That's the greatest illusion of them all, is that it actually matters which of the three candidates get in, you know, that...
I think it's funny how they fight over it. It's not going to be changing. Either, no matter who wins at this point, the candidates that you have right now, they're not going to be changing anything. They're just going to be making sure that everything continues the way it is. And the way it is that middle class is going to be shrinking. And unfortunately, people still have to learn the hard way. And it's going to be taking maybe another term until people say, okay, this no longer works. We really need something else. We cannot have the same thing about us being squeezed little by little, every drop of blood out of us. We need a different idea of what politics means, what a politician is, what a president should be representing. Right? Until that changes, people still are going to be suffering.
I totally agree. And so we're just going to have to track this. And I love the message. It's going to just take time. And this is going to be unfolding for a good long time. And so as it does, first I want to thank you for your time today. And then I want to know, what's the best way for people to follow your writings and your thinking?
Yeah, sure. I have my website, which is themodernsurvivalist.com. And well, as you mentioned, my books basically are explaining the kind of thing, the strategies that I applied myself that worked somewhat okay for myself. So as you get through this kind of thing, granted, Argentina was an economic collapse, but it's still valid for what people are going to be looking at in the future.
All right. So themodernsurvivalist.com will provide a link at the bottom of this with the transcript. So thank you, everyone, for listening today. And Fernando, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Chris.